All right, it's a new year, and we're going to talk about some old promises. In Isaiah chapter 55, going into a new year, there's a lot of people in the world that are filled with some, that are filled with a little bit of fear. Don't know what's going to happen next and what they should do about it. If you look at the news, it's depressing and terrifying, right? You just scroll through the headlines of wars happening all over the world, and invasions being planned, and economies toppling. I mean, I don't think most of us are aware of just how many wars are going on right now. How many nations are invading other nations? Most of us aren't worried about the border dispute and bullets being fired between, you know, India and China and between. I mean, there's some pretty scary stuff out there. You know, a couple days ago, there's Chinese warplanes flying within a few feet of American airplanes over near Taiwan as they're trying to get us to leave Taiwan so they can invade and take it over. And, you know, what's going to happen? There's some people rightfully wondering, you know, like, okay, we're so used to the technology and the wealth that we have today. And we remembered a few years ago when there was just a slight supply chain problem with the microchips. You know, how backed up the automobiles were and how expensive they got very, very quickly. And then when you realize that half of the world's microchips are made on that one tiny island, and the Chinese dictator has vowed it made his life's purpose to conquer that island. Now, when there's a steel factory or something like that, and a few bombs fall on the factory, you get men with arc welders out there and you fix whatever equipment is broken. Microchip factory, everything in it is calibrated to, you know, a few atoms of precision. One bomb falls in a $10 billion microchip factory, and it's out of commission for years. So in a matter of minutes, are the cell phones and the cars and stuff we're so used to will be gone, at least at the anywhere close to the prices we're used to. You know, that's over half of the world's microchip capacity. All of Apple products. You know, the microchips that Apple, you know, they're special. Look at this is our own microchip. They don't make their own microchip, right? So they like most other companies, they bought the design for the microchip from one company. They tweaked the design a little bit, and then they sent it off to Taiwan Semiconductor, right, to actually being made in the microchips. And then those microchips get shipped onto China, and then they get made into cell phones and come back here, right? Well, come here for the first time, right? So that's kind of how you get. So I mean, people are wondering. I mean, not conspiracy theorists or radical, you know, crazies are wondering. I mean, will we be able to buy iPhones, you know, by the Christmas of 2023, right? It's a legitimate question. Will those even be a thing? Because almost certainly, if that you know takes place, that Apple doesn't have a backup plan. Samsung would probably be the only major provider for cell phones. I mean, there would be no more Apple cell phones for quite a while, right? So the people that they discuss these things, they look at these things, and if you dig into it, boy, it's scary. You know, you see financial systems crashing. You look at the inflation, and you look at the interest rates going out of control, and all the sets of bad policy. And boy, it's really easy to get discouraged looking at our government and some bad decisions that are being made. You wonder how bad is it going to get in 2023, right? What will things be even like, you know, we're used to, or is this thing so bad we just kind of bunker down, right? We have that easy mentality, right? Things are not good, things are scary, things are terrifying, so we just kind of like, let's go into survival mode, right? Things are going bad, armies are brewing, invasions are coming, and countries are being taken over by other countries. Wars are going, alliances are broken, terrorists are blowing up power plants, and we're wondering, you know, where is this all going? And the reaction is just to kind of, let's not try to do anything new or go any farther. Let's just kind of get in survival mode and protect what we've already got and maybe just weather this storm. And that's a temptation. That's what we face. And now you got to understand, I'm going to read in Isaiah, and then we're going to go to Jeremiah. And the times of the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah were far more troubling times than even we live in, right? We worry about the rising powers of China or wars over in Europe and stuff like that, but they had Assyria and Babylon to deal with, and that threat was real, and there was no peace of any kind to be had. There was no international treaties, organizations. There was no United Nations. They didn't have nuclear deterrence, right? So that King Hezekiah didn't have a nuclear bombers that he could send over there. Hey, don't invade us or else. That's kind of his ultimate get out of jail free. No, they didn't have that. And there was nothing stopping the armies of Assyria and Babylon as they were going from city to city, conquering, taking everything, destroying everything. Not the kind of we'll just kind of gain some influence. No, you are slaves. It is over for you and your family, and most will die. That sort of war was coming, and if you look at the time of when Isaiah is written, it's not this little there's a threat way over there on the other side of the world. That's kind of what we can get scared about because we can see it on the news. You know, these cameras bring the other side of the world here, but it wasn't that. If you look at a map at that moment in time, you realize that at this point, Hezekiah's kingdom is a tiny little dot, completely surrounded by an empire that had conquered all the kingdoms around him. I mean, he was the last holdout. The world wasn't potentially getting bad. The world was ending. As far as people could see, the desperation, the need for salvation, the fear of what's happening, and they've seen. We're not talking like some distant country we see on. I mean, we're talking their neighbor. They know the people that live there, that city that they can see over there on the other side of the valley, was invaded by the Assyrians, and they can see from a distance the crucifixes going all the way up the road, of the people in that city, slowly dying as they've been crucified. Maybe they want to go do some trade and walk by. So it's a terror, it's a fear, and you can imagine starting off a new year there, in Hezekiah's day, and in the time of Isaiah, or later in the time of Jeremiah, just the fear that they had, and that what's going on in the future, where is this headed, do we have any hope? How are things going to end up? What's going to happen to us? And this need and the desire, and you talk about economic depression. Like we worry about, the bills, the inflation, all the bills are going up, and everything's getting more expensive, and we worry about that. And we understand they worried about that then. Things were getting much, much more expensive, and they were becoming much more impoverished. And here's the message Isaiah gives to this people worried about their wealth and worried about their safety and worried about all of that. And in Isaiah 55, he says, "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come ye, buy and eat. Eat ye, come buy wine and milk without money and without price." So here's supplies, here's a growth. You know what? This is not inflation, this is deflation. This is forget having to pay more. How about paying nothing? How would you like that price at the grocery store for your food? "Wherefore do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not?" You're working, you're laboring, but you're right now, I'm saying I'm giving you what you need for nothing. You're paying everything and not getting what you need. Come to me, you that are thirsty, you that are impoverished. Come to me, God is saying here. "Hearken diligently unto me, and eat that which is good, and let your soul delight in fatness." He's promising blessing in a time of fear and depression and destruction. It says, "Incline your ear and come unto me here, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David." Even the sure mercies of David. Now that, you might think of David and, okay, you know, he killed a giant with a slingshot. We know the story, right, you know? And you maybe heard about, maybe either you've been to the Christmas musical and, oh, it's the city of David. And they had to go there because they were the house and lineage of David. Okay. But there's a lot of context here, and you have to give me a moment to dig a little in the scriptures, and I encourage you, get the Bible reading schedule, go through it. And as you do, pay attention to this. Pay attention to the mercies of David as you read through the entire Bible. And you realize just how much weight that promise has. I'll give you the sure mercies of David. Oh, and hold on. Maybe he's just talking to them there. Yeah, there were the children of Israel. He was talking to David's seed. No, hold on. There's more to this prophecy, and we understand that Isaiah, more than really just about any other Old Testament book, prophesies of the coming Messiah, our Savior, Jesus Christ. He continues, and again, he's talking about David. I'm going to give you the sure mercies of David. He says, behold, I have given him for a witness to the people, a leader and a commander to the people. He's giving David he's a leader. He's given as a leader. Now, again, this is Isaiah writing. Okay, so this is hundreds of years after David died. David was given as an example. The promises God gave to an example is an example for us today. But it's not just to them, to that nation. Look at in verse 5, it says, but thou shalt call a nation that thou knowest not, and nations that knew thee not shall run unto thee because of the Lord thy God, and for the Holy One of Israel, for he hath glorified thee. We start to see what we're talking about here. This promise of all nations being blessed. This covenant he's talking about isn't the old covenant with Moses. He's talking about the new covenant. The new covenant that we know was in the blood of Jesus Christ. When he said there on that Passover day and said, hey, this cup is a new covenant in my blood. This promise that Isaiah is given here, he's not talking about, he's using as an illustration the Old Testament promises given to David, but he's talking about the New Testament. He's talking about the new covenant. He's talking about this everlasting covenant. And he's likening that to David and said, I'm going to give you the sure mercies of David. There's the example. What God promised to David and how he fulfilled that and how certain those mercies were. That's going to be extended to all of us today. We know now, and I'm not just saying that. For example, in Acts 13, Paul very clearly says that this passage is directly speaking of Christ in the new covenant. He says, and as concerning that he raised him up from the dead, talking about the resurrection of Jesus Christ, he says, now no more to return to corruption. He said on this wise, I will give thee the sure mercies of David. He quotes this passage. So Paul says this is talking about the promise of Jesus Christ and his testimony. And the New Testament that we have, that's what's going on here. And it says this in verse 6. Seek ye the Lord, while he may be found. Call upon him, while he is near. So he's promising us the sure mercies of David. We'll talk about what that means. And then he says, seek him while you can find him. Call him while he's near. And so I ask you this question, when is that? For how long does that last? Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. When is that? Is that in the year 700-something B.C. when Isaiah is being written? Is that in 690 B.C. when the last king descended from David is on the throne? Being taken off by the Babylonians? Is that the end of when he may be found? Does it extend to the New Testament? Does that promise extend to 2023? We know Isaiah, writing, 2,700-something years ago, he said to them right then, God is offering, come. Get your groceries for free. I'll give you what you need. You'll pay nothing instead of you paying everything and not getting what you need. Come to me. I'll make an everlasting covenant with you. I'll give you the sure mercies of David. Seek him while he can be found. Right now. Get those mercies. Get those promises that don't die, that are as certain as the promises I made to David. And we know it applied to them there. And what I want to ask is, does it apply to me in 2023? A new year, and we know that God has done great things in America, in this church, in the past. But we also see things changing, people turning away from God, sin increasing, sin that was always there becoming more open and outward, pushing it on our children. And we ask, is this offer still available today? So we need a context. We need to understand that Isaiah, there was no question. They knew very well the context. He was speaking in Jerusalem. They've actually, when they dug up Jerusalem, the area there by where the king's palace was, they found some of the little clay cylinders that was from Isaiah's signet ring that said belonging to Isaiah the prophet. You know that he would have stamped on his original scrolls. The scrolls, of course, have long since decayed. So we know he was right there, right in Jerusalem, right? The city of David, there that Jerusalem where David took over and had this kingdom. And the whole big claim to fame for that city is this is the kingdom of Judah. This is the throne of King David. And there was something really unique they had that's unique to all of history. And that is an amazingly long-lasting a dynasty. Right, so normally you have a lot of different in a kingdom. You'll have a king, and then his son will take over for him, and his son will take over for him. But they only last for so long before you get a really lousy son, and he's assassinated by someone else, or maybe you go so long and you're conquered by another kingdom. Usually it ends with the grandson that you know grew up being spoiled brat. You know is a terrible leader, and the people overthrow him, or they help some conspiracy to one of the generals often takes over. And it starts a new dynasty, right? That's the whole idea. It's this new dynasty starts, and as the new this king, and then his son. That's how the history of kingdoms go, and that's how the history of the northern kingdom of Israel went, right? So you had Rehoboam, and of course God wiped out his dynasty, and then you had Omri and Ahab and all of them, and then of course they were wicked, Jezebel and all that, and God has them wiped out. And again, when the dynasty ends, it's not just like, okay, someone else gets to be king. They go and find the entire family, everyone who possibly could claim any possible genetic descent from this king, any possible claim to the throne, and they killed them all. It didn't matter how young the child was. So there's some pretty gruesome parts of the Bible. Right, so when King Ahab's dynasty falls in his son King Ahab's son's time, right? There's this description of the heads of all the children and his grandchildren and stuff just stuck on poles, and it's gruesome. That's how it ends, right? That's pretty normal for kingdoms throughout all history and all kingdoms, right? So if you go to the Babylonian Chronicles, you can go to a museum in London and find this clay cylinder with marked, here's the list of all the kings of Babylon going back. Of course, the ones on the first page are like mythological ones that lived before the flood and stuff like this. And then eventually they get to ones that actually existed. And they kind of stretch it because they want to make it look like they're the biggest, longest lasting kingdom. But they have no qualms about the fact that, oh, yeah, and that king was murdered by someone else, and a new family took over, and a new family takes over here, and a new family takes over here. That's just how it is. And there's in Egyptian history, there's 30-something dynasties, I think, depending on which scholar you talk to, which ones count or don't count, and which ones are correct or not. But nonetheless, in Egyptian history, you know, one king. And so we have King David. And from the time of David all the way through, It's one family. That is amazingly unique in all of history. Seemingly impossible. And then what's even more amazing is you're like, well, yeah, okay, up to a certain point. And then the kingdom's wiped out and they're killed off. But the family isn't wiped out. And that's exceptionally rare that there continues to be those, even after there are not kings sitting on the throne, they're still rightful heirs to the throne. from then till today. They never succeeded in wiping out this family. And they tried on many occasions. One particular episode, they came within one child. There was one baby hiding in a back room, and that was the sole survivor. But nonetheless, this dynasty was never broken. The line was not broken. And that's a seemingly impossible thing. And they were very well aware as they were reading this passage how impossible it was, and they knew exactly why that was. A prophecy, the prophet Nathan, comes to David. So again, you know the story. David is king, and he wants to make a temple. And he goes to the prophet Nathan and says, I've got a beautiful mansion I live in. It's huge. It's got the cedars of Lebanon. It's beautiful. So it's fantastic, right? And look, we're worshiping God in a tent. I've got a beautiful cedar house, and boy, God is more important than me. Shouldn't God have a better house than I do? What a noble thought, and it was. And Nathan, the prophet, is like, oh man, that sounds like a great idea. We should totally do that. Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad you're worshiping God. You know, sometimes as pastors, we just hear someone say something that sounds like, we're so eager to see spiritual growth. We'll just, oh yeah, if it sounds good, oh yeah, let's, and then kind of stop later. Maybe not quite ready for that. Maybe you're not. So that night, Nathan has a dream, and God says, no, David's not going to build the temple. I don't want the temple built by a man of war. He gained that power by defeating armies. I want a man of peace to build the temple. It's going to be David's son. But then he has Nathan tell the future to David and make an amazing, astounding, earth-shattering prophecy. He says, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. And then in 2 Samuel 7:15, he says, but my mercy shall not depart away from him as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thine kingdom shall be established forever before me. Thy throne shall be established forever. A simple but earth-shattering prophecy that I'm never going to take my mercy from your family. Can you imagine that? Can I pray from I can pray that? God never take mercy away from my children, no matter how bad they mess up. As you contrast the two, Saul, he messed up a little bit. I mean, there were some later parts he messed up a lot, but I mean, the main thing he lost the kingdom from, he went in and he was supposed to make a sacrifice that he didn't. And later he made a little sacrifice, incense sacrifice that he wasn't supposed to make. And God said, I'm done with you. There goes the kingdom. King Solomon put high places on top of all the hills and made sacrifices to all the gods of his many wives. And God says, for David, your father's sake, I'm not going to take the kingdom from you. Well, I'll take most of it, but not all of it. I'll take a bunch of it from your son, but I'm going to keep the kingdom there. That is some certain mercy, undeserved mercy. You say, that mercy is available for me in my life? That's available this year? He reiterates it in Psalm 89. This is my covenant I will not break, nor alter the thing that is down on my lips. For once I have sworn in my holiness, this is God speaking, I have sworn in my holiness. That's something pretty big to swear by. That I will not lie unto David. His seed shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me, and will be established forever as the moon, and the faithful witnesses in heaven, Selah. That's some big promises. Some huge promises. But the ultimate fulfillment of that promise is Jesus Christ. And you say, is that available to me? Well, the book of Hebrews in the New Testament deals with that. Speaking of Christ, And contrasting, you had these promises in the Old Testament. We're going to get to both of them, but we have David and we have the Levitic priesthood. Neither which the David's kingdom and the priesthood of Aaron would never be broken. And Christ, in fulfilling both of those, in Hebrews 8 verse 6, it says, "But now he hath attained a more excellent ministry." Speaking of our high priest Jesus Christ and our King Jesus Christ. But how much also he is a mediator of a better covenant. Well, that promise that Nathan delivered to David, that's a pretty awesome covenant. I promise that your kingdom will never end. It's not like you're going to end. Now, God promises to one of the northern kingdoms, you're going to get four generations. And that's pretty big. That's a pretty decent dynasty. See, four generations, I'm not going to, no matter how. And he did. And God kept that promise. After four generations, then that family was wiped out. But us, no, infinite generations, forever. Forever. You'll never fail to have a son to sit on the throne. It's never happened. The thing about the great kingdoms of the past is their kings are all dead and their families are dead, killed off by rivals. But look what it says here. He's obtained a more excellent ministry by how much he is also a mediator of a better covenant. Look at this. Which was established, this is talking about Jesus Christ, our covenant, on better promises. Better promises. So here's what I'm going to talk about tonight. The promises God gave to David, they're just an example, a taste, an illustration, if you will. We don't just get the sure mercies of David. We get even better. And we have that this year, regardless of what's happened last year. So what about God's mercy? How sure are these sure mercies? Three areas, as we wrap this together here, three areas where David's, and I know I had this introduction, I had kind of explained the whole story there, but here it is, this certain promise to David, no matter what, you will always have your seed to sit on the throne. Number one, sin cannot annul God's mercy. So he says, I will be merciful to you. Sin can't change that. He promised to David, I'm not going to take away the kingdom from you or your sons the way I did to Saul. And God doesn't. You say, well, that's because David's family was more righteous than Saul. No, they weren't. Just by the nature of how long they lasted, they did much more wicked things, much, much more wicked things than King Saul ever did. God never takes the kingdom from them. And sin is destructive. There's nothing that separates us from God like sin. That is our state, separated from God, but sin is not more powerful than the promises of God. God said he's going to do something, he's going to do it. Look, I have kids here. They might hurt my relationship with my children if they disobey me. But that will never annul the relationship. There's no sin my kids could do that would make them not my children. Not even for a moment. They could break my heart. They can do great damage to me. But they can't do anything that would stop them from being my kids. They're my kids. My wife is my wife. There's nothing she could do that would break that relationship. God has made a promise. He didn't swear by our right. Remember, I noticed that he said, he swore in my righteousness. I'm not going to lie to David. Whoa. He didn't swear by David's righteousness. He doesn't swear by our righteousness. It's by his. He said, but I've done this and this and this. So I'm kind of used material. I can't be used of God in this coming year. I messed up. I tried to keep my resolutions last year. It was a failure. I'm not gonna make the same mistake this year. But are you moving into this year based on your past record or his? David moved forward not based on his righteousness, but God's. Of course, we know what happened. You know David's story. After this promise was made, and it's a promise of God, he doesn't go back on it. Then David stole someone's wife and murdered someone to take his wife. I mean, it's as bad as it gets. I mean, you can't get much worse than this, right? So he commits adultery, murders to cover it up, lies about it. That's as bad as it gets. And you think, well, surely that is so much worse than what King Saul did. The prophet's going to come right to David and say, you blew it. You're going to die. Someone else is going to get your kingdom. The prophet comes. prophet speaks some pretty stern words. Thou art the man, right? David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said unto David, the Lord also hath put away this sin. Thou shalt not die. What? That doesn't make sense by any. There's no. You could talk to even the most immoral law professors and philosophers in some secular college somewhere, and say, ethically, does it make sense that David would be forgiven of what he did? No, it doesn't. I mean, they allow for some horrendous immoral stuff that they are now winking at as okay in the public sphere. But if a politician did this today, okay, they would be out. Okay. They would be forced to resign very quickly. This was pretty bad. And God immediately, I mean, it's the next sentence. David says, I've sinned. And the prophet immediately comes back. God says, he's put away that sin. That certain of mercy is available to me? Yes, it is. And it goes on, and again, if you get the Bible reading schedule, go through, just you notice how many times you hear these words. But for David, my servant's sake, my servant David's sake, if you read through, it's all the way through there, again and again. Here's just a few, right? 1 Kings 11, wicked king takes, Solomon takes over, and God's going to take away the tribes. And he says, but he shall have one tribe, for David, my servant, for my servant David's sake, and for Jerusalem's sakes. In 1 Kings 15, and he walked by the, after the sins, this is another king, right? And he walked after the sins of his father, which he had done before them. His heart was not perfect before the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, did the Lord his God give him a lamp in Jerusalem and set up a son after him to establish Jerusalem. Why, here's that wicked king that didn't have it come. For David's sake, what? Because David is certain, no, because God made a promise to David. He doesn't go back. Right? And you go and you just keep going through. 2 Kings 8. And then we have, oh boy, Jehoram, right? The son of Jehoshaphat, right? And he walked in the ways of the king of Israel and did as the house of Ahab. Boy, he's really wicked. For he had the daughter of Ahab as was his wife. Oh man, what, this is getting bad. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord would not destroy Judah for David, his servant's sake. You say, did they get worse? They get much worse. The kings just keep getting worse after that. No, not the king. David's descendants. David's sons, grandsons, great-grandsons, they just keep getting worse. You get to get King Ahaz. Wow. I mean, in 2 Chronicles 20, I love the wording they use. For Ahaz took away the portion out of the house of the Lord and the house of the king and the princes and gave it to the kings of Assyria and helped him, and they helped him not. And in his time and distresses, and did he trespass yet the more against the Lord? He bad things happened, and he just kept going further against the Lord. Look at this. This is that King Ahaz. I love how the writer of Scripture is like, in case you're wondering, yeah, this is that one. In case you're there, because there's a couple different King Ahaz. This is the bad one. This is the bad one, right? It says, for he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus, and which smote him. And he said, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, therefore will I sacrifice unto them, that they may help me. But they were the ruin of him and all of Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God and cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God and shut up the doors of the house of the Lord and made him altars in every corner of Jerusalem and in every several city of Judah. He made high places to burn incense unto other gods and provoked to anger the Lord God of his fathers. Wow. I mean, that's okay. God has got to be done with his family by this point. This family's gotten far enough. I mean, they've messed up far enough. I mean, look how far they've gone. His son Hezekiah takes over. And now we're to Isaiah chapter 37. God, this is the son of that wicked king, the city that wicked king ruled over. And just the next generation, it says, for God is speaking, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. All of that, I mean, the people of Judah, they had literally torn all, they'd gone into the temple, took in all the things to worship God, melted them down and made idols, put boards over the temple. No one worships God anymore here. put up altars to every false god, put up these high places everywhere. And I mentioned sometime earlier, like they archaeologists dug up one of those high places. King Ahaz had bowls there filled with marijuana that burned, and when you walked in there, you got high, and you felt like you were in the presence of one of their gods. I mean, it was, he had ruined that kingdom. I mean, there was so much wickedness of every description. It goes on. I mean, you just keep reading about the witchcraft and the demon worship, and I mean, it's bad. And then here, the next generation, I'm going to defend this city. This wicked city, this terrible city? Yeah. For David's sake. Do you understand what's on offer when God says, I'm going to give you the sure mercies of David? Why don't you ask? Why don't you just ask? Instead of just worrying how bad was last year, how good will this next year, why don't you just ask for the sure mercies of David this next year? Stop worrying about, but I've done all this stuff in the past, and they've done all this stuff, and there's so much sin in the world. We can't go forward to the Lord because of this wickedness. No, we've got the sure mercies of David. It gets worse. Get to King Manasseh. Oh, man, you can't even get into that. I mean, it goes on and stuff. Like, look, he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He burnt his children alive to demons. That's King Hezekiah's son. I mean, it got worse. He took an idol. Instead of just now King Ahaz just boarded up the temple. Manasseh says, I'm not content with that. Let's tear the boards. Let's open up the temple. Go in there and use it as a temple to worship idols. He's like, how could I one up my wicked grandfather? Watch this. And it gets worse. And he's doing all of this, and it goes on, and just wickedness, wickedness, wickedness. And that's the context of this passage. That now we've come up to the point. Now it's King Manasseh is the king when Isaiah is born, and he's prophesying to Manasseh's grandchildren. Just go ahead and ask. I'll give you the sure mercies of David. You know, that same King Manasseh, the Bible records that he was taken as a punishment. God, he was taken captive and brought to Babylon, put in chains, and he prayed. Here's the key. To the God of his fathers, to the God of David, and God let him out, that wicked king, and gave him his kingdom back. Look, sin cannot annul God's mercy. Man cannot stop God's mercy. Now, I've got to get this one other passage in here, because this is powerful, okay? So let's go to the next prophet, Jeremiah, chapter 33. I know we got a lot of Bible verses I'm reading here. Jeremiah 33. But I want you to hear this. We think, But there's so much attack against Christianity today. We can't do what we used to be able to do. We can't run the buses like we used to run buses to reach kids. We can't get out there and soul because there's so much oppression against us. It's harder to minister to God today. The world, man, the opposition has made it harder, and we can't do what we want to do for the Lord. And here's this promise, but here's what finally happened, right? By the time you get to Jeremiah 33, the king, the son of David, was captured by Babylon. The high priest was captured by, here are these, I'm going to establish them forever in this city, in this temple, and they're taken away in chains, and they're chained up there in Babylon, and Babylon saying, you'll never be a kingdom again. You're now just part of our kingdom. You don't exist anymore. As a culture, as a people. And now they're coming to Jeremiah and say, what about that promise? Where are those sure mercies? And oh, you don't understand. So he says this in Jeremiah 33. And of course, this is this powerful passage. And the verses leading up to this are about the Messiah and the coming. This is that passage that talks about the branch of righteousness shall grow up unto David. You know, the stuff that we had the wise men read in the play, right? We get to verse 19. It says, and the word of the Lord came unto Jeremiah, saying, thus saith the Lord, if ye can break my covenant with the day and my covenant with the night, and that there be not, there may not be day nor night in their season, then may also my covenant be broken with David my servant, that he should not have a son to reign upon his throne, and with the Levites, the priests, my ministers. Oh, you think the king of Babylon can come and break my covenant? Let me tell you what, if you want to break my covenant, try this. This is a little easier. Stop the sun from rising tomorrow morning. Stop the whole sunrise, sunset, 24-hour cycle. Just go ahead and stop that. If you can figure out how to get that stopped, then you can figure out how to stop my promise to David. So I was thinking about it, you know. We know, and they knew even back then, you know, that the day-night cycle comes from the rotation of the world. Just what would it take to stop the world from spinning? You know, and then I was sitting late last night. I was pondering this passage, and I'm like, oh, it finally came back to me. You know, part of my memory I had suppressed. You know, somewhere deep in my subconscious. Back when I went to college, and I took all these math classes that I don't really use a whole lot as a pastor. And it just this brought back to my, wait a minute, there was that problem the professor gave me. He told me I had to calculate how much rotational energy the Earth has as it's spinning. It's one of those things. They have them in all the... So I ran downstairs and grabbed out books that had just been sitting there. I don't know why I keep them, but you know, maybe it's just... So here we go. I pull out my calculus textbook. Yes, this is not that big. Really, it isn't. But okay, here's my calculus textbook, and I flipped through it, and sure enough, found out. There it is. I remember when we did this assignment. You know, if you want to figure out the rotational inertia of a sphere, you just take the triple integral, you know, a function of the density and so forth, derivative over the, you know, and so we did that. I remember in calculus, you know, it's on page 983 of the calculus textbook in case you're really interested. You come check it afterwards, you know. And so you do that to figure out, you know, how much momentum it is in spinning this, right? And of course, that's not the energy. I remember, it was the physics professor that had me actually calculate the energy of the Earth spinning. Okay, so I grabbed that textbook. Now that textbook is so big, it's too thick, and they had to actually split it into five textbooks. So it's like this one textbook. It's all one page numbering, but they realized it was so big that you couldn't carry it in a backpack, so they split it up. So anyway, there's the physics textbook again. You know, this is the representation of man's knowledge and wisdom here, and let's see what man's wisdom says. Okay, that's the challenge. God's dropped us the challenge, and so let's see. I think I found it last night. Yes, sure enough, I was right. It was page 330, exercise chapter 10, problem number 66, and there it was. What is the rotational kinetic energy of the Earth about its spin axis? Model of the Earth is a uniform sphere. Use the data in the back of the book, and sure enough, there's the charts for all the planets and how much their mass is and stuff. Earth, I had to look it up, was 5.94 times 10 to the 24th kilograms. That's pretty heavy. That's 10 to the 24th, that means it's 24 zeros after it. That's how long the number is if you were to weigh the Earth. So what does that mean? Okay, so I did the math, right? It's great. It's fun. You do the math. It's here. I have it here somewhere. Yeah, see. It's this right here. You just do this math, okay? So you do those equations. Easy. It's a calculator, no problem, okay? You use a calculator, okay? So it comes down to this. How hard is it to stop the Earth? So the Earth rotates every 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4 seconds. You think, I thought it was 24 hours. Well, no, because it's also rotating around the sun, and you get an extra few minutes. That you lose a few minutes just by your motion around the sun each time. Anyway, so that's how fast it's spinning, right? So you use that and the mass, you know, those huge amount of kilograms. But you realize the reason why you have to use calculus and stuff is because, well, okay, a chunk of mass on the North Pole, it's just spinning, you know. And you think about if you took a giant iceberg and started spinning it, how hard it would be to stop, all right? So you just ask anyone that was on the Titanic, okay? They're pretty solid objects, all right? But that's just spinning, all right? So that's just spinning on its axis. But you notice out here on the closer you get to the equator, the faster you're going, as the Earth is spinning, right? You think, well, 24 hours to go around, that's not very fast. No, it's actually pretty fast, right? So the tallest point on Earth actually isn't Mount Everest. It's actually this mountain over here in Ecuador, Mount Chimborazo, and it's because it's right on the equator. Here's the idea about how much energy there is, God has in the spinning earth. The rotational energy is so much, the centripetal force actually pulls the earth outward and squishes it down. So earth is not a sphere like the paper globe depicts. It's actually wider around and shorter on the top to bottom because of the force pulling out. That's how much energy is in it. And so this mountain is actually further from the center of the earth than Mount Everest is. So that's a mountain that's, if you ever go there, it's a 35,000 foot high mountain, okay? And it's on the equator. Well, you know, again, you do a little bit of math there. Let's see here. It's going at the circumference of the earth is 40,000 kilometers around. That means it's going 460 meters a second, or roughly 1,000 miles an hour. So you've got this mountain here in Ecuador, and it's spinning around the earth at 1,000 miles an hour. So you can imagine stopping a freight train coming at you going 100 miles an hour. Now imagine a 13,000-foot-high mountain going 1,000 miles an hour. And that mountain is just a blip. Now, on these maps, you can feel the mountains on them, but that's exaggeration. Like, if you actually made a globe to scale, a Mount Everest, you would not be able to feel it. It's so flat. So, like, mountains that we think of as big are tiny in comparison to the world. So that's just a little speck. So add up, do the whole math for the whole Earth, and, yeah, it's a lot, okay? So the total energy, in case you're really wondering, you know, of the spinning Earth here, how much work does it take to stop the Earth? I mean, that's the challenge God has given to us. So we do the math here, and it's 2.14 times 10 to the 26th joules of energy. And that doesn't mean a whole lot to you, right? Unless you've gone through all the homework here. So let me say a unit of energy you might be more familiar with would be like what, kilowatt hours? So kilowatt hours, 6 with 22 zeros after it. That's how many kilowatt hours of energy. That's how much electricity energy it would take to stop it. So you say, well, what if? How much would that cost? Well, you know, at 17.2 cents per kilowatt hour, right? That's $10 billion for your electric bill. So there's once you get to a billion, that's beyond. Actually, a billion. Most people cannot comprehend numbers above 1,000, let alone million or billion. They're just numbers, right? It's just. But a billion, 10,000 billion, that's a lot of dollars, that's a big electric bill. And that's the electric bill you would have to pay if you wanted to do what God is saying here, go ahead and stop the earth. Go ahead and stop it from spinning. You know, go ahead and stop that day-night cycle. Okay, so put it in reference, let's say energy released by tons of TNT, so that's 5 with 19 zeros out of it, that many tons of TNT, or 51 quadrillion tons of TNT, explosive, that much energy. Well, I'll say, well, okay, if you take the bomb, the atomic bomb they dropped on Hiroshima, right, so you try to use that as a unit of energy, then it came out to, 34 million billion Hiroshima bombs. So what does that mean? Again, I can't visualize this, so here, maybe this will help you. If you set off an atomic bomb, the energy from atomic bomb every second, every time you snap your fingers, another Hiroshima atomic bomb, the one that dropped, you know, the first atomic bomb, another one of those goes off. Every second, and you do that 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, how long would it take to be enough energy to stop the Earth? And I did the math, and one atomic bomb a second would take you 100 million years. So again, those are absurd numbers we can't even imagine. Again, we're stuck back at somewhere thinking we can't imagine. Here's the bottom. What is God saying here? You're not getting me to break my promise. It's not going anywhere. Well, how do I apply that today, Pastor Mario? Well, look, there's some opposition out there. You say, well, this is tough. I mean, look at the energy, the price of gas going up. Maybe I can't come to church anymore. Maybe I shouldn't come out Saturday for an outreach day in 2023, you know, because it just doesn't work. I mean, with people reading all these science textbooks nowadays, they think they're smarter than the Bible. They're not going to listen anyway. And besides, I can't afford the gas to get out there and reach the world. Well, when your electric bill is $10 billion, then you can tell God he can't afford to get us to go reach the world. Start complaining when you figured out how to stop the world. What God has called me to do, he's promised the sure mercies of David. And how could he find something big enough? I mean, how do you even give? And say, well, let's try stopping the world. And by the way, that doesn't stop the daylight. So we still have, we're still orbiting around the sun. Yeah, that's 12,000. Just moving around the sun, that kinetic energy is 12,000 times more energy than spinning, just moving around the sun. And then you say, well, what about the energy that you really have to turn off the sun? How much energy does that put out in the well? That's in 1 year, 56,000 times more energy in 1 year the sun puts out than what I just described, spinning of the earth. You have to stop all of that, all right? So you say, well, but I'm afraid there's so what could happen in global politics? Should we really give to the church? Should we really keep moving forward? Should we go out there and run those buses? Should we teach a Sunday school class? I mean, I'm scared of what's going on in the world. Listen, when you find an army over in Europe that has 51 quadrillion tons of bombs, enough to stop the earth, then you can complain. Until they've got 51 quadrillion tons of high explosives, they don't have the energy to stop God's promise. God promised, and we can't exhaust it. And by the way, finally, I'll finish with this. Time cannot exhaust God's mercy. Sin can't annul God's mercy. Man can't stop God's mercy. Time cannot exhaust God's mercy. Here's David's number one song, the one when he got this promise, he got excited, he got the Ark of the Covenant, you know, there's some mishaps, but he got it to the place where Solomon was going to build the temple, and he got all these singers, and he gave them a new song to sing, and they sung these words, "Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." David was excited about that. His mercy didn't endure in those ancient times of the, you know, late Iron Age or something like that. No. His mercy endures forever. His mercy didn't endure up through the Roman Empire and the rise and fall. No. His mercy endures forever. It didn't extend through the Middle Ages and back in the Middle Ages, you know, people were all about religion and all that. So no. It didn't extend just up into the time of the Reformation and the those breaking from the Catholic Church or the founding of America and the great revivals in America. No, his mercy endures forever. And I've got to ask myself the question. If God's calling me to go and witness for Christ, and I'm making the excuses, you know what? Soul winning doesn't work today. If I go out there and just talk to people, people don't want to hear. Because you know what? They went to community college and they had heavy textbooks like this. And who can say anything about heavy textbooks like this, you know? Must be right. They're thick. And the teacher that taught me this physics class, he was an atheist and his PhD was in global warming. That's why he was teaching at a community college and not a more serious college, of course. But I can say, you know what? People have this now that they're not interested in the message from the Bible. They've got all this. And look what's happening in the world. People are too concerned about all this stuff, and the world is changing. We're old fashioned. This all going on. Hey, can I ask you a question? If you were to die today, do you know for sure you'd go to heaven? Would you like me to tell you from the Bible just how you could go to heaven? People don't want that message today, they say. Nah, that was back then. If it was back then, and it's not today, then the accusation I'm making of God is that his mercy has run out. And if I say, well, I've tried, I've gone out there, I've tried to do things, I've not seen a bunch of people get saved and today, and then people in Dover, they don't want to hear, they don't want to get saved, they don't want to hear the gospel. I got to ask myself the question, are they strong enough to stop the earth? Did God's mercy run out of steam? Or have I stopped asking? What did Isaiah say? Come, ask. Seek ye the Lord while he may be found. And you know, we just did the Christmas story. We know that all isn't the end of the story. We know we came to that little town of Bethlehem, the city of David. And Mary and Joseph had to come because they were the house and lineage of David. But there's more than that, and Matthew points it out. When you're, again, if you start this Bible reading schedule, you're going to jump right into something. I'm going to give you a preview of what you're going to read today, right? Because Bible, I know, I'm guaranteed it's Matthew chapter 1. So let me tell you, when you do your, grab your Bible reading schedule and you read Matthew chapter 1, and it starts, oh man, it's a list of names. Read that a little more carefully. That list of names goes from Abraham, God made promises, to David, all the way down to a carpenter in Bethlehem named Joseph. And along that list, you'll hear the names that I spoke of, Manasseh, and these wicked, wicked kings, King Ahaz. They're on the list. And their sin didn't stop the promise. Their mess-ups, their mistakes. It's not just guys on the list. If you read the list in Matthew, you'll notice. There's a Rahab. There's a Ruth the Moabitess. There's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. But wait a minute, that was that whole thing with, yeah. She's on the list. Both Mary and Joseph were her direct descendants. Yeah, she had Solomon, a more famous son. She had a later son she named after that pesky prophet, Nathan. And you know what? That Virgin Mary is descended from him. But actually, Matthew doesn't give her lineage. If you read Matthew, you're hearing Joseph's lineage. And you think, what is with that? Why is he going through? I mean, he's the son of God, not the son of Joseph. Oh, but it's important. Matthew takes the time to very carefully, because he was speaking to a Jewish audience, to carefully point out that they got legally married before Jesus was born. And although he's not the seed of Joseph, he's legally the heir of Joseph. And Joseph is directly descended from all of the kings of Judah, including the last king, and this is really significant. This is where that just kind of like, see, why was there like a 500-year gap where there were no kings? Well, the problem is that there's a apparent contradiction in Jeremiah. I read that passage in Jeremiah, right? But if you jump back in Jeremiah, you find something else back in chapter 22. And he's speaking of that last king, Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin, as he's called. There's a couple different ways of saying his name, right? He says, "The Lord, thus saith the Lord, write this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper sitting on the throne of David and ruling anymore in Judah." Oh, no. It sounds at face value. It seems like God has said, I've called it off. I'm done with the promises. No more mercies of David. But the thing about prophecy, you have to read each word very carefully. And I hope I say this, just as you start your Bible reading, you'll pay attention to little words. It's very significant. He says, no one of his seed. So here's the person that has the right, only his sons have the right to inherit the throne from him, the last legitimate king of Israel. But none of his seed will ever prosper sitting on the throne. Well, Jesus is not of his seed. He's of the seed of Mary. Jesus isn't genetically descended from Joseph. So Jesus doesn't get that curse. But Jesus is the legal heir of Joseph. So Jesus inherits the throne. See, for 500 years, they had no king. Even when Israel got their freedom back, and they had descendants of David, they didn't reestablish the kingdom and officially put up a throne, David's throne, because they knew of that curse. And they thought, they ran into a contradiction where Jeremiah in one chapter said, none of your seed will ever sit on the throne, and they will never die of David's seed. Well, Jesus is of the seed of David, not of the seed of Joseph, not of the seed of Jeconiah, right? But he is the heir of Jeconiah and all the throne of David. So he inherits the throne. God had it planned all the way, and all comes down to that one verse that we just gloss over as we read, Matthew chapter 1. Joseph, being raised from his sleep, did as the angel bid him and took unto him his wife and knew her not until she had brought forth her firstborn. And that firstborn is actually really significant. Son, and called his name Jesus. And if you go back through and read that list of names there, you'll notice he's not just randomly throwing in Ruth just because. Ruth and several of the others, it mentions Tamar and some others. Matthew is mentioning the times where inheritance went through a woman. And the key is it was a firstborn and who she was married to. The firstborn of a woman who's married to a man gets the inheritance. That's the way the Jewish law worked. And so it didn't matter that Jesus was not of the seed of Joseph. Joseph married Mary, and this was her firstborn son. He got the inheritance. So he got all the inheritance from Joseph, but he fulfilled all the promises of being the seed of David while not being of the seed of this cursed last king who, and now it broke the curse. Now we got through. It was the plan all along. As all these things tie together, all this, so you get to Matthew again. Hopefully, you'll want to grab the Bible reading schedule and go at least read Matthew 1 once again. Look at all these details. I don't have time to get into it, but look at them. Read all the little details. Read all the women in that list. They're actually really important to Matthew. These little details are really important because that's proving that, hey, God had always intended to keep that promise for eternity. And now Christ, sitting on the throne, one day will return. So his mercy can't run out. So what is it saying? What's the point of all of this? The point is today, doesn't matter in 2023 how much knowledge and science we have and what we know about the world. Doesn't matter how much political unrest we have around the globe and how terrifying things are in the world. The fact of the matter is, just like then, today, we can call on God and get the sure mercies of David. We want to reach people with the gospel. Those mercies are available to our neighbors too. This year, it's not just people that got in on the ground floor, people that have grown up in church. That's nonsense. Every one of us, no matter what sins we did last year, no matter what the world did last year, no matter how many years it's been, 2,023 years, probably 2,020 years, because we think we probably got off by 3 years on the. So it's a pretty nice 2,020 years since Bethlehem. Add another 390 years back that when Jeremiah made the promise, and it's still going strong. So seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. When is that? It's right now.